Antiquities, Book 19. How Gaius Caesar, plotted against by Cassius Caria, was killed, and how his uncle Claudius, compelled by the soldiers, took over the government. The conflict between the Senate and people on one side and Claudius with the troops that supported him on the other. The embassy of King Agrippa to the Senate, and how the soldiers, coming to terms with the Senate, went over to Claudius and made him master of affairs, while the Senate, left isolated, appealed to Claudius to be reconciled with it. How Claudius Caesar restored to Agrippa the whole of his ancestral kingdom and added to it the Tetrarchy of Lysanias. The edicts of Claudius Caesar at Alexandria on behalf of the Jews there and throughout his empire. The departure of King Agrippa by sea for Judea. The letter of Publius Petronius, governor of Syria, to the people of Dora on behalf of the Jews. How King Agrippa, while building the walls of Jerusalem at great expense, died before the work was finished and left it incomplete. Everything he did in the 3 years up to his death, and the manner in which he ended his life. This book covers a period of 3 years and 6 months. Gaius did not confine the madness of his arrogance to the Jews of Jerusalem and those who lived nearby. He sent it out over every land and sea subject to Rome, and filled the whole of it with countless evils such as had never before been recorded. Rome felt the horror of what was happening more than anywhere else, since he held her in no greater honor than any other city, but plundered and despoiled everyone, above all the Senate and those of its members distinguished by noble birth and the fame of their ancestors. Countless outrages were likewise found against the men called knights, who by rank and the power of their wealth were equal to senators, since it was from their number that men were called up into the Senate. These men were stripped of honor and driven into exile, killed and robbed of their property, since for the most part the killings were carried out for the sake of seizing their wealth. He proclaimed himself a god, and no longer thought it fitting that the honors his subjects paid him should be merely human. Going to the temple of Zeus, which they call the capital, the most honored of their temples, he dared to call Zeus his brother, and everything else he did fell no short of madness. Once, going from the city of Dicaeacia in Campania to Misenum, another town on the coast, and thinking it beneath him to cross by trireme, and holding besides that, since he was master of the sea, he was entitled to demand of it whatever could be demanded of the land. He bridged the sea for 30 stadia from headland to headland, enclosed the bay within it, and drove his chariot the whole length of the bridge. Since it was fitting, being a god, that his travels take such a form. He left no temple of the Greeks unplundered, ordering that everything of value in them, paintings, carvings, and all the remaining furnishings of statues and dedications, be brought to him. For it was not right, he said, that beautiful things should lie anywhere but in the most beautiful place, and that place, he held, was the city of Rome. With what was brought from there, he adorned his house, his gardens, and all his residences throughout Italy. He even dared to order that the Olympian Zeus, honored by the Greeks, and so named, the work of Phidias the Athenian, be carried off to Rome. He did not, however, go through with it, since the engineers charged with moving the statue told Memmius Regulus, who had been assigned to the task, that the work would be destroyed if it were moved. It is said that for this reason, and also because portents too great to be readily believed occurred, Memmius put off the removal, and he wrote a letter to Gaius in justification for leaving the matter unattended to, and by this was saved from the danger it brought upon him, since Gaius happened to die first. His madness reached such a pitch that, when a daughter was born to him, he carried her up to the capital and laid her on the knees of the statue, declaring that the child belonged jointly to himself and to Zeus, and appointing two fathers for her, leaving open which of the two was the greater. And people put up with him doing even this. He also undertook to allow slaves to bring accusations against their masters on whatever charges they pleased. For anything that might be said became terrible, since most such matters were settled by his favor, and at his prompting, so much so that a slave named Polydeuces even dared to bring an accusation against Claudius on a capital charge involving his own former master, and Gaius consented to attend the hearing, in hopes of finding an occasion to have him put out of the way. He did not, however, succeed in this. When he had filled with false accusations and evils the whole world he governed, and had raised the tyranny of slaves over their masters to a great height, plots against him were already forming on many sides, some out of anger, meaning to avenge what they had suffered, others thinking it best to deal with the man before great evils should befall them. Since then, his death brought great benefit both to the laws that govern all men and to the general security, and since our own nation would very nearly have perished had his end not come swiftly, I wish to go through the whole account of him with care. All the more since it carries strong proof of God's power, and offers comfort to those who live in adversity, and a lesson in restraint to those who suppose good fortune eternal and are led by it, wrongly, into further evil when excellence has played no part in it. Three separate paths, then, were being prepared toward his death, and over each of these good men held the lead. Aemilius Regulus, a man of Corduba in Spain by birth, was gathering some men, whether through others or through himself, being eager to bring Gaius down. A second group was being organized under the leadership of Cassius Caria, a tribune, and Annius Minucianus formed no small part of those preparing against the tyranny. Their reason for joining together in hatred of Gaius was, in Regulus's case, a temper angry at everything and given to hating whatever was done unjustly. For he had something spirited and free in his nature, which kept him from being able to conceal his plans. Indeed, he shared them with many, both friends and others whom he judged capable men of action. Minucianus was moved partly by vengeance for Lepidus, who had been his closest friend, and whom Gaius had put to death along with a few other citizens, and partly by fear for himself, since Gaius's anger, once let loose against everyone alike toward death, might at any time fall upon him too. This drove him to the undertaking. Caria bore the shame of the taunts of cowardice that Gaius kept bringing against him, and besides this reckoned that to risk his life daily under the guise of friendship and service, waiting for Gaius's death, was not altogether a free man's part. The conspirators also reasoned that the question of acting in the matter had, in effect, already been put before everyone in common, since all alike saw the outrage and longed, at the height of its fury, to escape it by bringing Gaius down. For perhaps they would succeed, and if they succeeded, it would be a fine thing to have won such great goods by laboring for the safety of the city and the empire, even though the undertaking be approached at the risk of death. But above all, it was Caria who pressed forward, out of desire for a greater name, and also because, thanks to his rank as tribune, he could approach Gaius without arousing suspicion, which would make killing him an easy matter for him. At this time, there were horse races. The Romans are passionately devoted to this spectacle. They come together eagerly at the race course, and gathered there in great numbers, they ask the emperors for whatever they want, and the emperors, judging such requests impossible to refuse, are never ungracious in response. So, on this occasion, the crowd, pleading fervently, urged Gaius to reduce some of the taxes and lighten something of the burden of the tribute. He would not consent, and when they shouted all the louder, he sent men out in different directions with orders to seize those who were shouting and lead them off and put them to death without delay. He gave the order, and those charged with it carried it out, and a great many died on that account. The people saw it happening but bore it, falling silent, seeing with their own eyes that to beg for the sake of money, in such circumstances, led straight to their own deaths. This drove Caria all the more to take up the plot and put an end to Gaius, who had grown savage against mankind. Often, even at banquets, he was on the point of making the attempt, but he held himself back on reflection, having already resolved beyond doubt to kill him, but watching for the right moment, so that he might use his hands not in vain, but to bring about what had been planned. He had by now been serving as a soldier for a long time, without any pleasure in Gaius's conduct. When Gaius set him to collect the taxes, and whatever other payments due to Caesar's treasury had fallen behind schedule, since the sum owed had doubled, he took his time over the collection, following his own manner rather than Gaius's instructions, out of a certain forbearance, taking pity on the hardships of those being taxed. And this provoked Gaius's anger, who accused him of softness for being slow in gathering the money for him. Indeed, Gaius heaped other insults on him besides, and whenever the watchword of the day fell to him to receive, he would give him womanish names, full of shame at that. And he did this without being free of such things himself. For at certain rites of mysteries which he himself instituted, he would put on women's clothing, devise for himself the wearing of braided wigs, and other things meant to give his appearance a false semblance of femininity. and yet he dared to call upon Kyria for the shame of such things. Whenever Kyria received the watchword, anger came over him, and still more whenever he had to hand it on, laughed at by those who received it, so that even his fellow tribunes made a joke of him. For whenever he was about to bring the watchword from Caesar himself, they would tell one of those accustomed to carry it in advance, turning it into a game. Because of this, he grew bold enough to take certain men into his confidence, since it was not against a few that Gaius vented his anger. Among these was Pompedius, a man of senatorial rank who had passed through nearly all the offices, but also an Epicurean, and for that reason devoted to a quiet life. Timidius, being his enemy, denounced him for using improper abuse against Gaius, bringing forward as witness Quintilia, a woman of the stage, celebrated among many, including Pompedius, for the brilliance of her beauty. And since the woman, for the charge was false, thought it a terrible thing to give testimony that would bring about the death of her lover, Timidius demanded that she be put to torture. And Gaius, provoked, ordered Kyria to torture Quintilia at once, without delay, using Kyria for bloody business and whatever required torment, in the belief that to escape the charge of softness, he would carry it out all the more cruelly. Quintilia, being led to the torture, trod on the foot of one of her fellow conspirators, signaling him to take courage and not fear on her account, for she would endure it with fortitude. Kyria tortured her cruelly, unwillingly, but under the necessity laid on him, and since she gave way in nothing, he brought her before Gaius in a state that gave no pleasure to those who looked on. Gaius, moved by the sight of Quintilia, so terribly disfigured by her sufferings, dropped the charge against both her and Pompedius, and honored her besides with a gift of money as some comfort for the disfigurement she had suffered, which had ruined the loveliness that had made her sufferings unbearable to behold. This deeply troubled Kyria, that he should be the cause, for men who deserved comfort even from Gaius, of such evils as had befallen them at his own hands. And he said to Clemens and Papinius, of whom Clemens held command over the armies, and Papinius was himself also a tribune, Clemens, it is not for want of trying that we fail to carry out everything the emperor demands of us. For of those who conspired against his rule we have, by our own diligence and toil, killed some and tortured others to such a degree that even he pitied them. And with what virtue, then, are we led out at the head of the troops? When Clemens fell silent, showing by his look and his blush that he bore what was ordered with shame, but judging it unsafe to draw them by word into speaking against the emperor's madness, out of concern for his own security, Kyria, now emboldened, spoke freely of the dangers, laying out to him the terrible state that gripped the city and the government, and saying that it was Gaius who, in name, bore the responsibility for such things, but that for those who tried to examine the truth of the matter, it was I. Clemens and Papinius here, and before us, you, we who inflict these tortures on Romans and on all mankind, serving not at Gaius's command, but by our own judgment, though it lies within our power to put a stop to a man who already treats citizens and subjects alike with such outrage. We have become bodyguards and executioners in place of soldiers, and we carry these weapons not for the freedom or the rule of the Romans, but for the preservation of the man who enslaves both their bodies and their spirits, defiling ourselves daily with the blood of slaughter and the torture of our own people. Until at last, someone will perform the same service against us, on Gaius's behalf. For he will not treat us kindly on this account. Rather, he will look on us with suspicion, all the more because so many who have already perished paid this same price. For Gaius's anger will never come to rest, since its end lies not in justice, but in pleasure. We ourselves will become targets in our turn, when instead it is our duty to secure for everyone freedom from conspiracy and from tyranny, and to vote ourselves release from danger. Clemens was plainly seen to approve of Caria's purpose, but he urged him to keep silent, lest the talk, spreading to too many and disclosing what it would be best to keep hidden, should get abroad before the deed could be carried out, and the plotters be punished once the plan became known. For the present, he said, they should leave everything to hope and to what time would bring, since some chance aid might yet come their way, for he himself, on account of his age, had been deprived of the daring for such things, but as for those under you. Kyria, though though I might perhaps suggest a safer plan once everything has been arranged and said. How could anyone contrive a more honorable one? With that, Clemens withdrew into himself, turning over in his mind both what he had heard and what he himself had said. Caria, however, in his eagerness, hurried off to Cornelius Sabinus, a military tribune whom he knew besides to be a man of note, a lover of freedom, and for that very reason hostile to the present state of affairs. He wanted to move quickly on what had been resolved, judging it good to bring such a man into the undertaking, and fearing too that word of it might leak out through Clemens, all the more since he reckoned delay and missed opportunities as the mark of men who let time slip away. Since everything about the plan was welcome to Sabinus as well, a man of no less resolve than Caria, but one who, for lack of anyone he could safely confide in, had until then kept his own intentions to himself in silence. Once he had found a man who would not only keep secret what he learned, but declare his own purpose openly, he was roused all the more, and needed no urging from Caria to delay any longer. The two of them then turned to Minucianus, a man bound to them by his own pursuit of virtue and by his kinship of great spiritedness, and one whom Gaius had come to suspect after the death of Lepidus. For Minucianus and Lepidus had been very close friends, as well as by the fear of the dangers that hung over himself. For Gaius was a terror to every man in office, since no one could tell against whom, or against how many, his madness would next be unleashed. And these men had made plain to one another their distress at the state of affairs, disclosing to each other directly both their thoughts and their hatred of Gaius, casting off the fear of danger, all the more since, perceiving each other's hatred of him, they had for that very reason never ceased to feel goodwill toward one another. Once they had made their approaches, since they were already in the habit, whenever they met, of holding Minucianus in honor for the preeminence of his standing, for he was the noblest of the citizens and the most praised on every count, Caria was all the more eager, whenever the subject came near, to be the first, if ever he met Minucianus, to ask what watchword he had received that day. For throughout the city, there was talk of the insult done to Caria through the watchwords assigned to him. Delighted at the remark, Minucianus, without any hesitation, answered him, trusting him with such conversation and speaking to him directly. "And you," he said, "are giving me a watchword of freedom. Thank you for rousing me to a boldness greater than I am used to summoning in myself. I need no further words to give me courage, if indeed this is your judgment too. We have shared the same purpose even before we came together to speak of it. I wear a single sword at my side, but it would serve for both of us. So come, let us take hold of the deed. Be our leader, command me to go wherever you wish, and I will go there, trusting in your help and your partnership in the work. Nor is there any lack of steel for men who bring their whole soul to the task. It is that very thing which makes steel itself effective. I have set out on this course not carried along by any hope of what I myself might gain from it. I have no leisure to weigh my own dangers, grieving as I am for the enslavement of a country that was once most free, for its laws stripped of their virtue, and for all mankind overtaken by ruin because of Gaius. I would deserve, with you as my judge, to be trusted in such a matter, since you think as they do and have not held yourself apart." Minucianus, seeing the force of these words, embraced him warmly, praised his daring, and stood close beside him. And after this embrace, with prayers and mutual pledges, they parted. Some maintained, as confirming what had passed between them, that when Caria was entering the Senate House, a voice came from the crowd urging him on, bidding him carry through what had to be done and take the god as his ally. And Caria at first suspected that one of the conspirators had turned traitor, and that he was being trapped, but in the end took it as encouragement. Whether it was a warning given by one of those in the secret to spur him on, or the god who watches over human affairs lifting him up. By now the plot had spread among many, and all stood ready under arms, some of them senators, others knights, and as many of the soldiery as shared the secret. For there was no one who would not have counted Gaius's removal a piece of good fortune. Because of this all were eager, by whatever means each could manage, not to fall short willingly of a share in so virtuous an act. And so far as each had zeal or power, all were roused, in word and in deed, toward the tyrant's killing, even Callistus, who was a freedman of Gaius, and alone among such men, had risen to the very height of power. a power amounting to nothing less than a rival tyranny, through the fear he inspired in everyone and the vastness of the wealth he had gathered. He was, in fact, the most venal and the most insolent man there ever was, having used his authority far beyond all reasonable measure. And knowing well besides that Gaius's nature was incurable, and that once he had condemned a man, nothing could ever call him back, and that he himself had many reasons to fear for his own safety, not least the size of his fortune, he had taken to secretly cultivating Claudius, going to sit beside him, in the hope that if the rule should pass to Claudius once Gaius was gone, he would already have laid the foundation of honor for himself through such past favors and a claim on his goodwill. He even ventured to say that, though ordered to do away with Claudius by poison, he had found countless ways to draw out the matter for his own profit. Callistus made this claim in order to win Claudius's favor. But the truth was neither that Gaius was so set on destroying Claudius that he tolerated Callistus's excuses for long, nor that Callistus, when ordered to carry out the deed, took it as something to be wished for if he had played the villain with his master's letters, he would not have failed to collect his reward at once. Rather, it was by some divine power that Claudius was preserved through the worst of Gaius's madness, while Callistus merely made a show of having secured a favor that in truth he had never done him. For Caria and his men, the daily delays were growing ever harder to bear, since many held back. But Caria himself was in no way willing to put off action, reckoning every occasion suitable for the deed. Often enough an opportunity presented itself. When Gaius went up to the capital, or during the sacrifices offered for his daughter, he might have been pushed headlong from the palace roof as he stood scattering gold and silver coin to the crowd below. The roof there is high and looks out over the forum, or again during the performances of the mysteries he was arranging, since on all such occasions he was off his guard, both because he took care to conduct himself becomingly in them, and because he had given up expecting to be the target of any attack, trusting that even the god's power over death would come to his aid, and if nothing held sacred stood in the way, he thought he himself would have the strength to kill Gaius even unarmed. Such was the pitch of eagerness with which Caria held the conspirators, fearing that the opportunities would slip away. They, for their part, could see that he wanted only what was right and was pressing for their common good. Nevertheless, they asked him to wait a little longer, lest, if some mishap attended the attempt, they should throw the city into turmoil with inquiries after those who shared the secret, and Gaius, forewarned, should bar the way to courage still more firmly against anyone who tried again later. It would be better, they said, to seize the moment while the games were being celebrated on the Palatine, held in honor of the first Caesar who had taken power from the people for himself, in a small wooden structure erected before the palace, where the noble Romans watched together with their wives and children, and Caesar too. It would be an easy matter, with tens of thousands of people packed into so small a space, for the bodyguard, once he entered, to have no room to act on his behalf, even if some of them were eager to help him. Caria held to this plan, but when the games came, and, though it had been decided to strike on the very first day, fortune proved stronger than their plan and granted one delay after another, so that all three lawful days of the festival slipped by, it was only on the last of them that the deed was at last carried out. Caria called the conspirators together and said, "Long enough has the time already passed for us to be reproached for our delay over a course resolved on with such courage, and it would be a terrible thing if, once word gets out, the deed should fall through and Gaius grow still more insolent. Do we not see that we are cutting away from our own freedom as many days as we grant, as a gift, to the growth of Gaius's tyranny, when instead we ought to be free from fear from this moment on, and, by giving others the cause of their happiness, stand forever after in the great wonder and honor of those who come after us." When the others could neither speak against him, since there was nothing honorable in doing so, nor yet openly embrace the deed, but stood struck dumb in silence, he said, "Why, gentlemen, do we go on delaying? Do you not see that today is the last day of the festival and that Gaius is about to sail away? He has made ready to sail for Alexandria, to see Egypt for himself. It would be a fine thing for us to let slip from our own hands the shame that will fall on Roman pride, paraded through both land and sea. How could we not rightly judge ourselves shamed by what is to come, if some Egyptian were to kill him, refusing to consider his insolence tolerable for men born free? For my part, I will endure your excuses no longer. I will go to meet the danger myself this very day, welcoming with pleasure whatever may come of it, and I will not put it off any further, if it can be done. For what could be more unbearable to a man of spirit than that someone else should kill Gaius while I am still alive, robbing me of the honor of this deed? Having said this, he set out at once to accomplish the act and put courage into the rest, and all were seized with a passion to join the undertaking without any further delay. At dawn, he was on the Palatine as usual, girt with the sword of the equestrian order, for it was the custom for military tribunes, once so girded, to ask the emperor for the day's watchword, and this happened to be the day on which it fell to Caria to receive it. Just then a crowd was gathering on the Palatine to secure seats for the show. Amid much noise and jostling, Gaius taking delight in the people's eagerness for such spectacles. For this reason, no place had been set apart, either for the Senate or for the knights, but men and women sat mixed together in disorder, and free men were mingled with slaves. When his procession had gone forth, Gaius offered sacrifice to the deified Augustus, in whose honor the games were being held, and as one of the victims fell, it happened that the toga of Asprenas, one of the senators, was drenched with its blood. This made Gaius laugh, but it proved to be an omen made plain for Asprenas, since he was killed immediately after Gaius. It is recorded that Gaius, contrary to his own nature, was remarkably affable that day, and that by his charm in conversation, he astonished everyone who happened to be present. After the sacrifice, he turned to the games and took his seat with the most distinguished of his companions around him. The theater was rebuilt each year in this fashion. It had two doors, one leading to an open courtyard, the other to a colonnade, for entrances and exits, so that those shut inside would not be thrown into confusion. And within the wooden structure itself, partitions marked off a further space where the performers and all manner of entertainers could move about. While the crowd sat together, with Caria and the military tribunes not far from Gaius, Caesar occupied the right wing of the theater. A certain Bathybius, a senator of Praetorian rank, asked Cluvius, a man of consular rank sitting beside him, whether any rumor of a coming upheaval had reached him, taking care as he spoke not to be overheard. When Cluvius said he had heard nothing, Bathybius replied, "Well then, Cluvius, a contest of tyrannicide lies before us." And Cluvius said, "My good man, be quiet, let none of the other Achaeans hear that story." As a great abundance of fruit was showered on the spectators, along with many birds of the kind, prized for their rarity by those who caught them, Gaius watched with delight the scrambles and struggles of the crowd as they claimed the prizes for themselves. It was there, too, that two omens are said to have occurred. A mime was performed in which a captured chieftain is crucified, and then a dancer performed a piece about Cinyras, in which both he and his daughter Mirha are killed, with a great deal of artificial blood poured out, both around the crucified man and around the figures of Cinyras. It is also agreed that this was the very day on which Pausanias, one of his own companions, killed Philip, son of Amyntas, king of the Macedonians, as he was entering the theater. As Gaius hesitated over whether to remain to the end of the show, since it was the last day, or to bathe and dine and return afterward as he had done on the previous days, Minucianus, who was sitting above Gaius and feared that the opportunity might come to nothing, rose when he saw that Caria had already gone out ahead of him and hurried to go and encourage him. But Gaius caught hold of his cloak, seemingly in friendliness, and said, "Where are you off to, my good man?" Minucianus, out of what seemed respect for Caesar, sat back down, but his fear got the better of him, and after a short pause he rose again. Gaius put no obstacle in his way as he left, supposing he was going out for some necessary reason. Ambrones, too, was urging Gaius, as before, to withdraw for his bath and his meal, and then come back in, since he too wanted the plan brought to its completion. Meanwhile, Caria's men were stationing one another wherever the moment required, each straining to hold his assigned post and not desert it. They were growing vexed at the delay and at the postponement of what lay in their hands, especially since it was already about the ninth hour of the day. As Gaius lingered, Caria grew eager to force his way in upon him where he sat, though he knew well this would mean a great slaughter of the senators and of as many knights as were present. Yet, fearful as he was, he remained eager, judging it a good thing, in purchasing safety and freedom for everyone, to count the fate of those who would perish as a small price. And so, with everyone now turning back toward the theater. At the signal of his entrance, Gaius rose to his feet, and a commotion broke out. The conspirators, too, turned back and began pushing against the crowd, ostensibly because they were annoyed at Gaius, but in reality wanting to isolate him from anyone who might come to his defense so that they could get at the business of killing him unopposed. Going ahead of him were Claudius, his uncle and Marcus Vinicius, his sister's husband, and also Valerius Asiaticus, whom not even the conspirators, had they wished, had the power to bar from his path, out of respect for their rank. Gaius himself followed with Paulus Aruntius. Once he was inside the palace, he left the direct route along which the attendant slaves were stationed, and the men around Claudius were walking ahead, and turned instead down a quiet passage, meaning to go to a spot near the baths, and at the same time, to look over some boys who had arrived from Asia, a procession of whom was then in progress, with hymns for the mysteries he was celebrating, and others rehearsing war dances to be performed in the theaters. Caria met him there and asked for the watchword. When Gaius answered with one of the words kept on hand for mockery, Caria did not hesitate. He hurled abuse at Gaius, drew his sword, and struck a violent blow, but it was not a fatal one. Some indeed say it happened by Caria's design, that he meant not to kill Gaius with a single stroke, but to punish him more severely with a multitude of wounds. I myself do not find this account plausible, since in actions of this kind fear leaves no room for calculation. And if Caria really thought that way, I judge him, of all men, to have been supremely foolish, indulging his anger for the sake of pleasure rather than securing, by one swift blow, deliverance from danger for himself and his fellow conspirators. For many means of rescue might still have come to Gaius's aid had he not lost his life before they could act. And then Caria would have had to answer not for punishing Gaius, but for the fate of himself and his friends. When in fact, had he struck well and kept silent afterward, he might have slipped past the wrath of Gaius's defenders, rather than risk, with the outcome still uncertain even in success, losing both himself and the opportunity through such reckless conduct. This I leave for anyone to judge as he pleases. Gaius, reeling from the pain of the blow, for the sword, aimed at the point between shoulder and neck, was stopped from going deeper by the collarbone, neither cried out from the shock nor called upon any of his friends, whether from disbelief or sheer bewilderment, but groaning under the pain, he threw what strength remained into flight. Cornelius Sabinus caught him, his resolve already broken, and shoved him down, and as he sank to his knees, a crowd gathered around him and, at a single signal, cut him down with their swords, urging one another on and vying to outdo each other. Last of all came Aquila, who, this is agreed by everyone, dealt the blow that finished him for certain. One might rightly credit the whole deed to Caria. For even though it was carried out with the help of many others, he was the one who first conceived it, having anticipated all the rest by far, and he was the first to declare it boldly to the others. And once they had taken up his proposal for the killing, he gathered together the scattered participants and organized the entire affair with sound judgment, proving far superior to the rest wherever a plan needed to be put forward, and he won them over with persuasive words, so that although they had hesitated, he brought them all to act. And when the moment came to use the hand, he showed himself here too the first to charge, the first to lay hold of the killing by his own courage, making the way easy for the others and Gaius already as good as dead. So that whatever the rest went on to do might justly be credited to Caria's resolve, his courage, and the labor of their hands. Gaius, then, having met his end in this fashion, lay there, his life drained out from the sheer number of his wounds. As for Caria and his companions, once Gaius was already finished off, they saw that it was impossible to save themselves by returning the way they had come, both from dread of what had happened, for it was no small danger for men who had killed the emperor, given the people's foolish devotion to him and their affection for him, and given that the soldiers would carry out the search for his killers with more than a little bloodshed, and also because the streets along which they had done the deed were narrow. and a great crowd, together with the attendants and however many soldiers were on guard duty for the emperor that day, had blocked them off. They therefore went by other routes and arrived at the house of Germanicus, Gaius's father, whom they had just killed, a house connected to the palace, since the whole complex was one continuous building, extended by each successive ruler through his own additions, some parts even taking their name from the ruler who had begun the construction, though it was never finished in his reign. Having slipped through the crowd, they found themselves, for the moment, safe from pursuit, since the disaster was still unknown, that the man who held the empire had been killed. The first to learn of Gaius's death were the Germans. These were bodyguards who bore the name of the nation from which they had been recruited, forming a Celtic unit of their own. It is a national trait of theirs to give themselves over to rage, a thing rare among other barbarian peoples, because they are less inclined to let reason govern their actions. They are powerful in body, and, charging with their first onset against whomever they take for enemies, achieve great results. These men, on learning of Gaius's murder, were deeply grieved, not because they judged the matter by any standard of right, but by their own advantage, and above all because Gaius had been dear to them, having bought their loyalty with gifts of money. They drew their swords. Their commander was Sabinus, a tribune not through the merit and nobility of his ancestors, for he had in fact been a gladiator, but one who had won, through sheer bodily strength, the standing needed to command such men, and they went through the house searching for Caesar's killers. They cut down Asprenas, who happened to run into them first, the man whose robe, as I have said earlier, had been stained by the blood of the sacrificial victims, an omen that boded nothing good for what followed. Second came Norbanus, one of the most distinguished of citizens, who counted many consuls among his ancestors, and who put up resistance. But they showed no regard at all for his rank, and being the stronger, wrested the sword from the first man who attacked him, making it plain he did not intend to die without a fight. Until, surrounded at last by a mass of assailants, he fell under the weight of his wounds. Third was Antius, one of the senators, who along with a few others had not run into the Germans by chance, as the previous men had, but out of a longing to see for himself, and take pleasure in the sight of Gaius lying dead, so as to satisfy an old hatred. Gaius had driven Antius's father, who bore the same name, into exile, and not content with that, had had him killed by soldiers sent after him. And so Antius had come, for this reason, to gladden himself with the sight of the corpse. But when the household grew alarmed, he thought to hide himself, and yet did not escape the Germans, whose thoroughness in the search matched their fury in the killing, falling alike on the guilty and the innocent. Such was the death of these men. When word of Gaius's death reached the theater, there was shock and disbelief. Some, even those who received news of his destruction with great pleasure, and had long counted it a blessing were it ever to happen, were nonetheless incredulous, out of fear. Others were altogether without hope that anything of the kind had befallen Gaius, and would not credit the report as true, since they thought it impossible that a man of such power could meet such an end. These were the women, the children, whatever slaves there were, and some of the soldiers. The soldiers because they served for pay and were nothing but partners in his tyranny, using their share in his outrages to extort both honor and profit from the leading citizens. The women's quarters and the younger crowd, as a mob will, were captivated by the pleasures of public shows, gladiatorial exhibitions, and distributions of meat, things done, in name, to gratify the people. But in truth to feed, out of Gaius's own madness, his cruelty. The slaves, for their part, having gained a voice of their own and license to defy their masters, had no protection against anyone who abused them, except the favor his rule afforded them. For it was easy for them, by lying accusations against their owners, to be believed, and by denouncing their property to have both freedom and wealth granted them as the price of their testimony, since an eighth share of the estate was held out to them as their prize. As for the nobility, even where the report seemed credible to some, whether because they had known of the plot beforehand, or because they simply wished it true and so believed it readily, they gave it away to no one, concealing in silence not only their joy at the news, but even their opinion of whether it was true, some fearing that, should their hopes prove false, they would be punished for having rushed to betray their feelings. Others, who knew for certain because they had shared in the plot, hid it all the more from one another, each ignorant of the other's involvement, and afraid that if they spoke to the wrong man, one to whom the continuance of the tyranny was advantageous, they would, with Gaius still alive, be denounced and punished once the informer came forward. For another rumor had also spread, that he had indeed been wounded but had not died, and was alive under the care of physicians. No one trusted anyone else enough to declare his own view with confidence, for whoever showed himself a friend of Gaius became suspect of favoring the tyranny out of genuine goodwill toward it, while whoever showed hatred toward him found that the very absence of goodwill in the man he spoke to was enough to make his words be doubted. It was even said by some, and these did the most to extinguish the nobles' cheerful hope, that Gaius, careless of danger and entirely unconcerned about his wounds, had gone out, just as he was, drenched in blood into the forum, and was there addressing the people. This, however, was mere conjecture, born of the reckless wish of those eager to spread such talk, and taken by their hearers however they pleased. Still, no one abandoned his hiding place, for fear of the charge that would fall on anyone who came out too soon, since they had no confidence that judgment upon them would be made on grounds they thought fair, but rather on whatever grounds their accusers and their judges chose to imagine. When a crowd of Germans, swords drawn, surrounded the theater, every spectator expected to be killed, and at each new entrance panic seized them, as though they were about to be cut down on the spot. They were at a loss, with neither the courage to leave nor confidence that staying inside the theater was safe. As the Germans began bursting in, a cry rang out through the theater, the crowd turning to plead with the soldiers, protesting that they had known nothing of what had been plotted by the conspirators, if indeed there had been a plot, nor of what had happened afterward. They begged, therefore, to be spared, and not made to suffer punishment for another man's daring when they themselves were not even implicated, asking that the search for the actual perpetrators be carried out first, and only then whatever was found to be true be acted upon. Such words, and more besides, they spoke amid tears and the beating of their breasts, calling on the gods and pleading whatever the danger standing so near taught them to say, as anyone fighting for his life would. At this, the soldiers' anger broke, and they repented of their design against the spectators, for it seemed cruel even to men so far hardened, once they had already set up the heads of Asprenas and his companions upon the altar. At the sight of these heads, the spectators were moved all the more, both out of regard for the men's rank and out of pity for their suffering, so that they themselves, having come through dangers no less severe, came close to being stirred up in turn, with an outcome that, had it run its course, no one could have foretold. So it was that even those who hated Gaius eagerly and with justice were kept from the joy of having rid the country of him, since they too had stood on the edge of destruction along with him, and confidence in their own survival had not, even now, become secure. There was a certain Euerstus Arruntius, one of the public auctioneers, who through that trade had developed a powerful voice, and had acquired wealth to rival the richest of the Romans, and possessed the influence to do as he wished in the city, both then and later. This man, composing himself into as mournful a bearing as he could manage, though he hated Gaius as much as any man, judged nevertheless that self-restraint and a plan aimed at securing his own safety mattered more than the pleasure of the moment. Having arranged himself with all the trappings a man might assume for the loss of his dearest possessions, he came forward into the theater and announced Gaius's death, and put a stop to the people's continuing any longer in ignorance of what had happened. By this time, Stilas Arruntius, too, had arrived, calling off the Germans, and the tribunes with him ordering them to lay down their weapons and making clear to them that Gaius was dead. This, above all, was what most surely saved those gathered in the theater, and everyone who happened, in any way, to fall in with the Germans. For had hope reached them that Gaius still lay alive and breathing, there is no atrocity from which they would have held back. Such was the surplus of their devotion to him that they would have been ready, even at the cost of their own lives, to see that no plot against him went unavenged, sharing in so great a misfortune alongside him. They ceased their furious pursuit of vengeance once clear word of his death reached them, both because it would now be pointless to display such zealous devotion to a man who, being dead, could no longer reward them for it, and out of fear that if they press their violence further, it might draw the attention of the Senate, should power come to rest with it, or of whatever ruler succeeded him. And so the Germans, though only with difficulty, ceased at last from the frenzy that had seized them over Gaius's death. Caria, meanwhile, was greatly afraid on Minucianus's account, lest he be destroyed by falling in with the Germans' madness, and went around to each of the soldiers, begging them to look to Minucianus's safety, and taking great pains that he not perish. Clemens rescued Minucianus, for he had been brought before him, releasing him along with many other senators, bearing witness to the justice of the deed and to the courage of those who had conceived it and had not shrunk from carrying it out. Tyranny, he said, may for a time rise up on the pleasure taken in its own outrages, but those who wield it are not granted, in the end, a fortunate departure from life, since the hatred of virtue stands set against it, but rather a misfortune of the kind that in fact overtook Gaius, at the hands of those who rose up and organized the attack against him. He himself, Gaius, had come to be such a man, and by the very outrages that made him unbearable had taught, in destroying the law's providence, that his own dearest kin should turn to war against him, so that now, though in name it is these men who have killed Gaius, in fact he lies destroyed by his own hand. By now the theater, too, was rising up out of the fear that had at first gripped it so bitterly, only gradually relenting. The reason for its eagerness was this. Alcyon the physician, having been swept up as though to attend to some of the wounded, sent away those with him on the pretext that they too were going to fetch what was needed for the wounded's treatment, but in truth so that they might learn of the danger that had arisen. Meanwhile the Senate met, and the people gathered, as was their custom, for assembly in the forum to search out the murderers of Gaius. The people very eagerly, and the Senate too, it seemed. There was a certain Valerius Asiaticus, a man of consular rank. He came forward before the people, and when they were in an uproar and treated it as an outrage that the killer of the emperor was still unknown, since all of them eagerly asked him who the man responsible was, he said, "Would that it were I," the consuls also published an edict denouncing Gaius, and ordering the people and the soldiers to return to their own business, promising the people great hope of relief, and the soldiers' honors, if they remained orderly and were not led into any of their usual violence. For there was fear that, should they turn savage, the city would suffer through their plundering and through the looting of temples. By now the whole body of senators had already assembled, and above all those who had joined in the murder of Gaius, already acting with boldness and holding themselves in great pride, as though affairs now rested entirely in their hands. While matters stood thus, Claudius was suddenly seized from his house. For the soldiers, having held a meeting among themselves, deliberated with one another about what should be done, and concluded that a democracy could never come about, given power over affairs of such magnitude, and that even if it were achieved, gaining such rule would not turn out for their own good, and that if any one man should hold command, it would go badly for them in every way unless they had made themselves partners in his power. It seemed good to them, then, while the matter was still undecided, to choose Claudius as their leader. He was the dead man's uncle, and of all those gathered in the Senate none was more distinguished, both in the excellence of his ancestors and in the learning he himself had pursued, and that once established as emperor he should be honored fittingly and rewarded with gifts. This they resolved and carried out at once. Claudius, then, had been seized by the soldiery. Gnaeus Sentius Saturninus, though he had learned of Claudius's seizure and that he was laying claim to power, seemingly against his will, but in truth by his own wish as well, came forward before the Senate and, quite unshaken, delivered, as befits free and noble men, this exhortation. Even though it may seem past belief, Romans, because after so long a time it comes unhoped for, still we possess the standing of free men, uncertain how long it will last, resting as it does on the will of the gods who have granted it, but sufficient to bring us joy, and, should we be deprived of it, sufficient in itself to count as happiness. A single hour is enough for those who have a sense of virtue, if it is lived out with a mind wholly its own, in a fatherland governed by its own laws, the laws under which it once flourished. As for me, I can forget the freedom of earlier days, since I came after it was gone. But the freedom of now I drink in without ever being satisfied, and I count blessed those who were born and raised in it, and I judge these men worthy of honor no less than the gods, men who have, late as it is, and even at this stage of our lives, given us a taste of it. May its security remain for the whole age to come, but even this single day would be enough for our younger men, and for those of us grown old it will be reckoned a lifetime, provided the elder among us, having had our share of its blessings, may now depart this life, and the younger have, as an education in virtue, this good order established for them by the very men from whom we are descended. And now, given the present hour, nothing should matter more to us than to live with virtue, which alone secures freedom for mankind. The events of old I know only by hearsay, but from what I have witnessed with my own eyes, I have learned with how many evils tyrannies fill our commonwealths, hindering every virtue, stripping the high-minded of their freedom, and turning themselves into teachers of flattery and fear, because they leave everything not to the wisdom of the laws, but to the anger of those who rule. From the time Julius Caesar set his mind on overthrowing the Republic, and by force overrode the order of the laws and threw the state into confusion, making himself stronger than justice, yet weaker than whatever might bring him private pleasure. There is no evil the city has not worn through, as all those who succeeded him in power vied with one another to erase the ways of our fathers, and to leave the citizens as bereft as possible of noble men. They believed it made for their own safety to keep company with counterfeit men, and not merely to diminish something of the pride of those trusted to excel in virtue, but to condemn them utterly to destruction. And though many such men displayed things unbearable, each in his own rule, Gaius alone, who died today, showed himself more terrible than all of them, unleashing an untutored rage not only against his fellow citizens, but even against his own kin and friends, inflicting ever greater evils on everyone alike and exacting punishment unjustly, growing savage toward men and toward the gods in equal measure. For under tyranny, pleasure is not simply enjoyed, nor does its insolence stop at wronging property and wives. The whole gain lies in troubling the enemy's entire household. And everything free is an enemy to tyranny, so that it cannot be won over to goodwill, nor can those it has wronged ever count their sufferings as small. Knowing full well what evils they have filled others with, some tyrants show great-spirited contempt toward fortune, but, unable to hide from themselves what they have done, believe they can win freedom from suspicion in only one way, by destroying utterly those they suspect. Now that we are rid of such evils, and have made ourselves accountable to one another, which is the surest guarantee a commonwealth can have, both for present goodwill and for future security from conspiracy, and so that credit may belong properly to whoever guides the city rightly. It is right that we take thought for this, since its benefit falls to the common good. And let anyone displeased with the proposals already made state his own opinion in reply, without this bringing him any danger at all, since whoever presides will be no unanswerable master with power to harm the city, and, as sole ruler, remove those who have spoken against him. Nothing new nourishes tyranny except idleness and the failure to oppose anything it wills. Overcome by the pleasantness of peace, and having learned to live after the manner of slaves, all of us who have heard of irremediable disasters and seen the evils befalling our neighbors have, out of fear of dying with honor, endured our own ends instead with the utmost shame. First, then, we must bestow the greatest honors there are upon those who removed the tyrant, and above all upon Cassius Caria. For with the gods' help, this one man has shown himself the provider of our freedom, both in judgment and by his own hand. It is right not to forget this, but since he took counsel for our freedom against the tyranny, and at the same time faced the danger first, to vote him honors for that freedom, and let this be declared the first act done under no compulsion. It is the noblest deed, and one fitting free men, to repay their benefactors. And such a man has this one been toward all of us, in no way like Cassius and Brutus, who killed Gaius Julius Caesar. For they rekindled for the city the beginnings of civil strife and civil wars, whereas this man, along with killing the tyrant, has also delivered the city from the horrors that would have followed from it. Such were the words Sentius used, and the senators received them with pleasure, as did all the equestrians who were present. Then a certain Trebellius Maximus leapt up and pulled the ring off Sentius's finger, A stone engraved with an image of Gaius was set in it, because in the eagerness of his speaking, and of what he intended to do, he had, it seemed, forgotten it was there, and the engraving was broken. Night had already come on far, and Caria asked the consuls for the watchword, and they gave liberty. What was happening seemed to them a wonder, almost past belief, for it was the 100th year since they had first been deprived of the Republic that the giving of the watchword passed back to the consuls, since these men had been masters of the soldiery before the city fell under tyranny. Caria, having received the watchword, handed it on to the soldiers stationed with the Senate. They numbered 4 cohorts, for whom having no king was more honorable than tyranny. These men then withdrew with their tribunes, and by now the people too were departing, full of joy, hope, and high spirit over the man who had won leadership for them, no longer over whoever happened to preside. And Caria was everything to them. Caria, for his part, thought it a terrible thing that Gaius's daughter and wife should still be alive, and that ruin should not fall on his whole household together with him, since whatever of them remained would be left standing for the ruin of the city and its laws. And being eager besides to bring his own purpose to completion and to fully satisfy his hatred of Gaius, he sent out Julius Lupus, one of the tribunes, to kill Gaius's wife and daughter. Since Lupus was a relative of Clemens, they assigned him this service so that, having taken part even in such acts, he might be honored by his fellow citizens for the virtue of the tyrannicide, as one who could be thought to have shared from the start in the whole plot among those who first conspired together. But to some of the conspirators, it seemed a cruel thing to use such violence against the woman, since Gaius, they thought, had done everything driven by his own nature rather than by her counsel. The very acts that had worn the city out with the evils that overtook it, and by which whatever was the flower of its citizens had perished. Others, however, laid the responsibility for such things on her own design, and blamed her for all the evils Gaius had done, saying she had given Gaius a drug that enslaved his mind, and had contrived to draw him into love for her, so that, once he had been driven into madness, everything that followed was of her own making, built up against the fortunes of the Roman people and of the world subject to them. In the end, it was decided that she should die, for those who tried to delay, it could do nothing to help her, and Lupus was sent. He wasted no time in any hesitation of his own, so as not to fail to serve those who had sent him at the right moment, wishing to be blameless in nothing that concerned the people's benefit. Coming to the palace, he found Caesonia, Gaius's wife, lying beside her husband's body where it had fallen to the ground, deprived in her misfortune of everything the law would grant the dead, smeared with blood from his wounds, overwhelmed with grief, her daughter flung down beside her. Amid all this, nothing was to be heard from her but reproach of Gaius, for not having found convincing what she had so often foretold to him. This remark was interpreted both ways at the time, and still today lies open to the same treatment, according to whatever inclination the minds of those who hear it choose to give it. Some said it meant that she had advised him to abandon his madness and govern the citizens with moderation and virtue rather than savagery, and that it was for following his own way instead that he perished. Others said that when word of the conspirators had reached Gaius, she had urged him to deal with all of them at once without delay, so as to stand clear of danger even if they were guilty of nothing, and that this was the very thing now being thrown back at her as a reproach, that though she had foretold it, he had proved too soft-hearted to act. Such, then, were the things said about Caesonia, and this was what people thought of her. Now when she saw Lupus approaching, she pointed out Gaius's body to him, and with wailing and tears, begged him to come nearer. But when she saw him standing rigid in his resolve, coming no closer, like a man bent on a deed not to his own liking, she recognized what he had come to do, and bared her throat for the blow, crying out most eagerly the sort of things natural to those who have so plainly come to despair of life, urging him not to delay in bringing to completion the drama already resolved upon against them. And so, with great courage, she died at Lupus's hand, and after her the little daughter as well. Lupus hurried to report all this to Caria and his men. Gaius then died in this way, having ruled the Romans for a 4th year lacking 4 months, a man who, even before he came to power, was perverse and had reached the very extreme of wickedness, a slave to pleasure and a friend to slander. cowed by whatever was truly frightening, and for that very reason, most murderous toward whatever he dared face, glutting his power in one thing alone, committing outrage against those toward whom he least should have shown it, driven by an irrational arrogance, and making his profit out of killing and lawbreaking. He was eager both to be and to seem greater than what is divine and lawful, yet was a slave to the praise of the crowd, and counted as virtue everything the law judges shameful and punishes. He forgot friendship, however great and however deeply founded, toward anyone he had once grown angry with, through the shock of punishing even the smallest offenses, and he regarded everything allied with virtue as his enemy, brooking no contradiction in whatever his desire commanded. Hence he even had relations with his own full sister. And it was from this above all that the citizens' hatred of him began to grow more intense, since a thing unheard of for so long a time invited both disbelief and enmity toward the one who had done it. One could point to no achievement of his reign that benefited either the people around him or those who would come after, except for the project he conceived at Regium and Sicily for the reception of the grain ships from Egypt. This, admittedly, was a very great and useful undertaking for sailors, yet it was never brought to completion, but was left half-finished because his enthusiasm for it grew dull. The cause was his devotion to worthless things and his spending on pleasures which, taken by themselves, might have done him good, but which, in fact, drained away the ambition he had once professed for higher pursuits. In other respects, he was an excellent speaker, thoroughly trained in both the Greek language and the ancestral tongue of the Romans, and he could grasp on the spot the arguments composed by others, even those built up over a long time, and reply to them extempore, so that in the greatest matters he appeared, through sheer quickness, more persuasive than anyone else, both from a natural facility for the task, and because he had added to that facility the strength that comes from practiced effort. For being the son of Tiberius's nephew, whose successor he became, he was under great compulsion to devote himself to education, since Tiberius himself excelled and took the first place in it, and Gaius shared this devotion to fine learning, deferring to the letters of a kinsman and a ruler. And so he came to hold first place among the citizens of his time. And yet the goods he had gathered from his education proved unable to withstand the ruin that overtook him through the possession of power. So hard is it to acquire the virtue of self-control for those who have at their ease the freedom to act without being called to account. He made use of friends, all of them men of worth, at the outset, driven by his education and his desire for glory to emulate his betters, until, once his excessive insolence turned their goodwill toward him into a hatred that grew up secretly within them, he was plotted against by them and died. Claudius, as I said above, once the breach with the ways of Gaius had occurred, and the household was thrown into confusion by the calamity of Caesar's death, being at a loss over how to save himself, took refuge in a certain narrow passage and hid himself there, suspecting no cause for danger except his own high birth. For as a private citizen, he had lived modestly and was content with what he had, devoting himself to learning, above all Greek learning, and keeping himself in every way apart from anything associated with turmoil. At that moment, with panic gripping the crowd and the whole palace filled with soldierly madness, cowardice, and disorder among men who, private citizens as it were, had taken up the role of bodyguards, those attached to the so-called general staff, which is the most respectable part of the army, were deliberating about what should be done, while those who happened to be present set little store by vengeance for Gaius, since his fortunes had justly come round upon him, and instead considered rather how their own affairs might turn out well, and how the Germans among the executioners, who acted out of their own savagery rather than out of concern for the common good, might be dealt with in reprisal. Claudius was thrown into confusion by all this, fearing for his safety, especially since he had seen the heads of Asprenas and his companions being carried past. He stood in a certain recess, reached by a few steps, keeping himself concealed in the darkness there. And Gratus, one of the soldiers attached to the palace, caught sight of him, and being unable, because of the darkness, to make out clearly who it was, but not disposed to doubt that the man crouching there was indeed a man, came closer, and when Claudius wished to draw back he pressed on and, seizing him, recognized him. "This is Germanicus," he said to those following him. "Let us set him up as our leader, carrying him along with us.